Barrick, again, contributor of the Schiller Institute. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikko Vitale, it's goodbye until next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
We draw your attention to verses 54 and 55 of chapter Araf from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. إِنَّ رَبَّكُمُ اللَّهُ الَّذِي خَلَقَ السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضَ فِي سِتَّةِ أَيَّامٍ خلق السماوات والأرض في ستة أيام ثم استوى على العرش يغشي الليل النهار يطلبه حثيثا والشمس والقمر والنجوم مسخرات بأمره ألا له الخلق والأمر تبارك الله رب العالمين ادعوا ربكم تضرعا وخفية ادعوا ربكم تضرعا وخفية إنه لا يحب المعتدين صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Surely your Lord is Allah, who created the heavens and the earth in six periods of time, and He is firm in power. He throws the veil of night over the day, which it pursues incessantly, and He created the sun and the moon and the stars, made subservient by His command. Surely His is the creation and the command. Blessed is Allah, the Lord of the worlds. Call on your Lord humbly and secretly. Surely He does not love those who exceed the limits.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran says U.S. Foot Dragon on making a political decision about its return to compliance with the 2015 nuclear agreement has put the Vienna talks in limbo, but Tehran will not wait for the West. Iran once again slammed the Swedish court's illegal jail term for its citizen, calling for the full acquittal and immediate release of Hamid Nouri. The United States and South Korea begin their largest combined military drill since 2018 in a dramatic escalation of tensions on the Korean Peninsula. This is World News, a live broadcast from our Tehran headquarters with me, Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. Top story this hour, Iran saying the United States is to blame for the delay in an agreement on the revival of the 2015 nuclear deal. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani says Washington is yet to give a response to the draft text proposed by the European Union. The spokesman says that the U.S. needs to show real will to restore the nuclear accord. Kanani also says Iran responded to the EU's proposal in a constructive way and has shown enough flexibility in the talks. Tehran submitted its response to the proposal a week ago. The U.S., however, says it is still assessing Iran's response. Iran's Foreign Minister Sulaymi Abdullahian calls for the immediate release of Iranian national Hamid Nouri, who has been handed a life sentence by a Swedish court. Hamid Abdullahian described as unacceptable the court's process of trial and verdict. He said that Nouri should enjoy basic rights, including medical access, as well as the right to contact his family. The top Iran diplomat made the comments in a meeting with a Swedish ambassador to Tehran. Hamid Nouri was detained in Sweden. In 2019, he was sentenced to life over the alleged rights violations against members of an anti-Iran terror group, MKO. In the 1980s, Tehran has already called the charge against Nouri baseless and fabricated. Now, another U.S. Delegation is in Taiwan as tensions are running high, with China following the controversial August 2nd visit by U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. The governor of the U.S. state of Indiana is in Taipei for the third time this month. Eric Holcomb held talks with Taiwanese president on what it called mutual strategic partnership. In a meeting, President Tsai Ing-wen slammed China's recent drills near Taiwan. She called for support against what she called military threats from China. U.S. delegations have been paying back-to-back visits to Taiwan over the past month. China, which considers Taiwan part of its territory, regards the visit as a challenge to its sovereignty. Beijing has accused Washington of threatening regional peace and has conducted several military drills near Taiwan. The United States and South Korea have begun their biggest combined drill since 2018, a move likely to draw angry reactions from North Korea. The exercises run for nearly 10 days, and they include the largest-scale field training abandoned under the previous South Korean administration to make room for peace. More details are yet to be released. Such war games have involved deployment of aircraft, warships, and tanks, and tens of thousands of troops in the past. South Korea and the U.S. say that such drills are pure defensive, but North Korea sees them a rehearsal for invasion. The maneuvers have also pushed Pyongyang to fire a blitz of missiles this year. These include the first launch of an intercontinental ballistic missile since 2017. The top Israeli court has rejected an appeal for the release of a Palestinian prisoner who has been on hunger strike for 172 days. According to Khalil Awada's lawyer, the court turned down the request and affirmed the decision to freeze his administrative detention. Awada was supposed to be freed on September 15th, but a court denied their request after Israel's internal spy agency, Shin Bet, handed over a confidential file to the judge. The Palestinian resistance group, Islamic Jihad, has also demanded Awada's release as part of a ceasefire that ended three-day Israeli aggression on Gaza earlier this month. Awada has been on a hunger strike since March 4th to protest his administrative detention, a policy that Tel Aviv follows to indefinitely imprison Palestinians without any charge or trial. Calls are growing for the British government to push for the release of a Leeds University student who's been languishing in a Saudi prison since last year. She was arrested when returned to the kingdom to visit her family. The student is charged with following and retweeting dissidents and activists. In our news review program, we've discussed why Western governments turn a blind eye to Saudi Arabia's checkered human rights record.
It's time for our news review of this bulletin. The UK government is facing calls to act after a PhD student at Leeds University was jailed in Saudi Arabia for using Twitter. Opposition Labour lawmaker Hilary Benn has called on Foreign Minister Liz Truss to press for the release of 34-year-old Saudi Salma al-Shahab. Ben says that Britain has a duty to speak out over the case of the mother of two. Al-Shahab was detained last year after returning to Saudi Arabia to visit her family. Earlier this week, an appeals court sentenced her to 34 years in prison, followed by a 34-year travel ban for tweeting on women's rights and for retweeting posts calling for the release of imprisoned activists in Saudi Arabia. The ruling has drawn growing global condemnation, with activists calling it outrageous and shocking. Al-Shahab says that she has been subjected to abuse and harassment during her interrogations. Saudi Arabia has been under fire internationally for its poor human rights record, but earlier this year, Truss declined to criticize the kingdom, saying that Riyadh is an important partner of the UK. Sayyid Mohsen Abbas is a journalist and political commentator, joining us from London. And we also have Masoud Shajara, head of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, also joining us from London. Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Masoud Shajara, first over to you. What has occurred over here is quite shocking, and I'd like to find out from you how you see the claims made by Saudi Arabia in the, on the advancement of human rights, especially through its crown prince, obviously, and what this verdict actually truly speaks.
Just enough the behavior of the Saudi Arabia. I mean, this is supposed to be a reformist regime. And if this is a reformist regime, God forbid what, you know, the rest of the regime is all about. And the fact of the matter is outrageous, it is unbelievable, it's shocking. You know, really, it's difficult to find the words to describe this. But what is even more shocking is the fact that Britain and the rest of the Western world are totally silent. The silence from these governments is shocking and is deafening. You know, this is sort of, these are the same government who consider themselves the champions and flag bearer of human rights, and they go around even start wars for bringing democracy and human rights, and here they are totally silent and using financial interests as excuse for allowing this sort of barbaric action, outrageous action to take place, and you know, supporting it with their silence.
Simon Abbas, do you think that the UK should remain silent here, or should it say something? How do you view its either action or inaction?
Well, obviously, from any kind of ethical, civilized point of view, the British should speak out. But the fact remains, Britain always puts its economic interests over any kind of ethics and morality. And all the window dressing we hear about human rights and protecting the lives of people around the world is really just it's just for the purpose of duping their own public and creating a public relations image which makes them seem like they're kind of all holier than thou. The reality, of course, is much darker, because Britain, as with most of the Western or the Anglo-American empire, the Western powers, behind them there are economists that dictate their political policies. In this instance, let's just look very carefully. We know that there are about 30,000 prisoners held, political prisoners of conscience held within this Saudi system. We know that the Saudi courts are a complete joke in terms of the way they operate, and they operate with impunity, where arbitrary arrests are fine, you know, keeping prisoners incommunicado in detention, and then handing out 34-year sentences for somebody who likes a couple of tweets. I mean, doesn't that just sum up exactly what their kangaroo courts are about? And the kind of people that they lock up largely are reformists, human rights activists, lawyers, innocent, you know, political people and social workers as well. Religious scholars aren't spared, and bloggers. So there's a whole litany of cases, and this is just one amongst many. But going back to what I was pointing out about the economic hypocrisy of Western powers, well, MBS has a stake in Twitter, and Twitter is at the heart of all of this this latest case in which this young lady, Salma Shahab, has been very, very ruthlessly dealt with. And MBS, Mohammed bin Salman himself, has a stake in Twitter. They have a public investment fund, the Saudi Sovereign Wealth Fund, and it owns something like 17 or 20% of the stake. So you can see that there's a conflict of interest, and yet it's this Twitter account which was used by Salma al-Shahab which has got her into jail. But just in this same way, you can see the corruption that exists between Western corporate companies, the Western political parties, which are also subject to the lobbying of the Saudis. You saw that in the Khashoggi case, for instance, and you see how they literally get away with murder, let alone sentencing a virtually innocent woman for the most menial of supposed misdemeanors, which was simply stating her political views or support of people who were not necessarily in favor of the government. This is a draconian establishment supported sure. by a very devious and cunning power behind them. They do it because they get oil. And I'm afraid until the Western public takes responsibility and campaigns against their own governments, there can't be any change with what the Saudis do, because they were just given the green light by Joe Biden, who came over and gave them carte blanche to do what they wanted, essentially. And you're seeing now the consequences of Biden's visit, where the Saudis are becoming emboldened to incarcerate, capture, torture anybody they like on the most kind of the menial, most menial of misdemeanors, if they are that at all.
Well, there is two things. One is the states of U.S. and Western European sort of hegemony, and when you are in that category, be it Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, you actually get away with murder. And, the government won't do anything about you. The sort of national papers will not touch you. And there is another part, and that is a corruption. There is a huge corruption going on. These dealings and meetings which is taking place, let us not forget, what happened to Tony Blair when he left office. He received millions from the Saudis for his projects. So really, there is level of corruption, and indeed, this issue of being part of the ideological thing. Then you could get away with it. We could get away with murder, in the same way that Israel gets away with murder. And I really don't think it's just an issue of pounds and pennies. When you look at how much export takes place between Britain, for example, and Saudi Arabia, it really is just a few points, few percent. Is not a really huge, it's not something that Britain will go bankrupt if they speak out against the Saudis. But I think the relationship between the elite of over there and the elite of here, and the dealing and wheeling that they do among themselves, which really should be exposed as corruption, it's actually the reason for them being able to get away with this.
Thank you for that, Saeed Mohsin Abbas, journalist and political commentator, and Masoud Shajar, head of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, both from London. Thank you both. With that, we come to an end for this edition of the News Review. Thanks for tuning in.
Moving on, the chief of Israeli firm NSO is stepping down. That's the firm that makes Pegasus malware to spy on activists, politicians, journalists, and even heads of state worldwide. The company spokesman says the move is part of an internal reform to ensure the firm remains one of the world's leading high-tech cyber intelligence. The company, which is said to be highly indebted, says it would now focus sales on countries belonging to the NATO alliance. For years, it's been mired in controversy for selling spyware to government clients to spy on their citizens. Recently, the European Commission found signs indicating that phones of some top EU officials were hacked using the same malware. Pegasus can switch on a phone's camera or microphone. NSO Group claims the software is only sold to target criminals and terrorists with the approval of Israeli officials, but media has cited many court documents suggesting malware was even provided to countries with questionable human rights records. The Taliban government in Afghanistan has called on the UN Security Council not to use Western sanctions as a pressure tool against the country. The Taliban Foreign Ministry spokesman also warned about a stern response if travel bans on Afghan officials are not lifted in accordance with the Doha Agreement. Abdul Ghaffar Balkhi issued the warning in tweets ahead of a planned UN security meeting on Monday. The 15-member body is to decide on ending travel ban for 13 Taliban officials after the waiver expired late on Friday. The Council in its last session failed to reach a consensus. Balkhi noted that the continuation of the ban would provoke Africans to take their own measure, which he said would not be in the interest of anyone. In June, the Security Council extended travel ban for top African officials, including deputy prime ministers, for 2 months. Several thousand have gathered in central Sao Paulo to hear from former president of Brazil, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, in his largest rally since the officials started the election campaign. From Sao Paulo, Camila Escalante has a report.
Brazil's presidential frontrunner has pledged to tackle hunger and ensure food security as the country has returned to the United Nations hunger map as a result of the neoliberal policies of his opponent, incumbent Jair Bolsonaro. Former President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva says there's no explanation for the dire circumstances within the country. Lula da Silva was joined at his first major rally in Brazil's largest city by several towering political figures of the Brazilian left, including former President Dilma Rousseff. Lula is counting on the support of some of the largest unions and social movements on the continent, whose leaders have vowed to return the Workers' Party to the government. All polls show former President Lula with a significant margin over Jair Bolsonaro, and Lula is continuing to gain ground and enjoys a higher level of support than the sum of all other candidates combined.
From here, we expect to see Lula embark on a Brazil-wide tour and meet with a range of sectors from which he seeks to lock down support. Camila Escalante, Sao Paulo.
That's a wrap for this News Bulletin. Goodbye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrents fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willst, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from Thee: the facility to obey Thee at its beginning, and the favor of Thy forgiveness at its end. O He who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand,
in the midst of proud mountain. Closer, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. This is the gas. I filled my car and don't need to go to gas station for about a week. To be honest, I hate the smell of gas. Makes me feel bad. The oil and petrochemical products may remind many of Iran, though I particularly remember the city of Abadan in southwestern Iran, which its name is mingled with oil and oil refinery. Actually, today we are going to take a trip to Abadan in order to visit an amazing museum. Yes, Benzinkhane Museum, literally Gasoline House Museum. The first gas station in Iran was established at the center of the city of Abadan by British Petroleum Company in 1927. This site was initially used as a place for selling and distributing kerosene, though after a time, and by the import of cars to Iran, this site changed into a gas station. Earlier, fueling was done by manual pumps and then sold to customers. Benzinkhane Museum of Abadan, with an area of 1,856 square meters, is located in proximity of a new gas station in this city. The main building of the museum holds the documents, papers, and objects related to the gas station, including pumps, measurements, tins, and other devices which have been put on display. There are also two other minor buildings in the area, one used for exhibiting all the documents related to the distribution of petrochemical products in the country, and the other one used for the convenience of the visitors. I am now at Abadan Airport. I just got off the plane. The humid weather and the special scent of this city, which comes from petrochemical products. These two features tell me that I am in the city of Abadan. I love this city. I am now at Benzinkhane Museum of Abadan. At the main gate of the museum, there is a sign which reads, "The first gas station of Iran." Let's go inside the area of the museum. Such a pretty area. Oh, wow, palm trees. Eucalyptus trees and bougainvillea bushes have all made a very beautiful scenery. I am now at the western part of the area of the museum. Here, there is a collection of gas station equipment, each organized according to the year of its production and completion process. Oh, look. This is a glass manual pump. The sign next to it says, "This pump dates back to 1925. And here there are 12 systems made in Britain, US, Japan, as well as Germany, Australia, and India. Oh my God, this is amazing! Here, there is a gas station dating back to 1927, which is actually reconstructed. It's a brick-made building, which has a sign in Farsi and old fonts that reads, "The Center for Selling Homemade Products." And on the other side, there is an advertisement which reads, "Just use the pure parse gas." And here, there is an old red Opel car, which is reconstructed, actually. This car is put in front of a replica of one of the oldest gas station systems in the world. There is also a replica of a gas station worker dressed in uniform, filling a car. It's made creatively. Oh, I completely feel I have traveled to 1927. Though I wasn't born at that time. I am now in another hall of the museum. In this hall, there are domestic and industrial devices which work with petrochemical products, as well as banknotes and stamps related to the oil industry. There are also different types of lamps, kerosene lamps and kerosene stove. Remind me of my grandma's old house. And on the walls, there are old black and white photos. In this old photo, you can see men and women standing in a queue waiting for oil. Oh, look at here. There are different types of graduated measurements and 20-liter tins special for carrying fuel and petrochemical products. I was wondering how hard life was at those times. If you happen to visit Benzinkhane Museum of Abadan, look at the newspaper ads in this museum. I'm sure the old photos and writings which advertise oil make you feel excited.
Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. On this programme, we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organisations, communities and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So, stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will look at the 1 year since the Taliban takeover in Afghanistan, the botched exit of U.S.-led allied forces, and the humanitarian crisis unfolding in the country. And we shall also discuss how India and Pakistan fare 75 years after their independence from British colonialism, also the challenges and opportunities facing them.
This week, last year, the Taliban laid siege to Kabul after dramatic advances across the country, overthrowing the West-backed government and forcing Americans to beat a hasty retreat. It came almost two decades after the US and its allies carpet-bombed Afghanistan on the pretext of decimating the Taliban and Al-Qaeda and capturing Osama bin Laden. The events leading up to the Taliban's comeback and the botched exit of foreign forces showed why and how the Hindu Kush country has been the graveyard of powerful empires.
Taliban staged a stunning comeback on August 15, 2021, toppling the West-backed government led by Ashraf Ghani and forcing the U.S. and its allies to abandon the South Asian country after years of futile military adventure. For two decades, the war in Afghanistan remained an enigma for the successive U.S. governments, from George Bush to Joe Biden, finally ending in a botched exit. It all started on February 29, 2022, when then-U.S. President Donald Trump's administration signed an agreement with the Taliban to pull out U.S. troops from the country by May 1, 2021. The deal, however, failed to de-escalate tensions between the two sides. On April 14, 2021, President Joe Biden announced that the remaining 2,500 to 3,500 U.S. troops in Afghanistan would withdraw by September 11 to end what he called America's forever war. Between May and August 2021, the Taliban overran several key provincial capitals, with the beleaguered Afghan forces offering little resistance. On August 15, 2021, the Taliban finally marched into Kabul without firing a single bullet as the U.S.-backed government officials fled the country. A day after, thousands of panic-stricken people flocked to the Kabul airport, desperately looking for evacuation flights. The disastrous war ended the way it started, in a violent, disorderly, and reckless fashion.
The Taliban takeover and the hasty U.S. withdrawal spawned the worst humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan, especially after the U.S. froze the country's assets worth $9 billion U.S. dollars and halted billions in development aid. According to the United Nations, almost half of the country's population is today battling with acute hunger, including a large number of children. To rub salt on the wounds of Afghans, President Biden distributed their assets as compensation to the victims of the 9/11 attacks, drawing anger and outrage from Afghans.
1 year since the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, the Taliban government in Kabul continues to struggle with a rapidly deteriorating humanitarian situation in the country amid crippling U.S. sanctions and a shortage of funds. Millions of Afghans are without work now. The banking system is virtually dysfunctional. Medical facilities are lying in tatters. And the worst humanitarian catastrophe in modern history is in the making. Almost entire Afghan population is living below the poverty line today, according to the UN Development Program. Many Afghans have expressed anger over the Biden administration's decision to withhold billions of dollars in frozen assets from the Afghan Central Bank, distributing large parts to the families of the 9/11 victims. Worse, the U.S. sanctions have devastated the banking system and blocked global humanitarian organizations from delivering aid to Afghans. Neil Turner, the Norwegian Refugee Council's country director, commenting on the first anniversary of the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan and freezing of assets by the U.S., recently blasted the U.S. and the international community for pushing millions of Afghans into despair. Some prominent American and international economists also wrote a letter to Biden, urging him to release Afghanistan's frozen reserves, while expressing concern over economic catastrophes unfolding in the country.
Now, to have more insight on this, we are joined by Mr. Mohammed Asif, the director of Afghan Human Rights Foundation based in Scotland. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Asif. Now, 1 year since the Taliban takeover in Afghanistan, how were the motorcycle-borne Kalashnikov-wielding guerrilla fighters able to pummel the world's most powerful army with the most sophisticated weapons?
Because the invasion of Afghanistan was a failed war from the very start. You know, when Britain and America and NATO went to Afghanistan and they created this interim government, you know, in Bonn, probably if you remember the Bonn Agreement in Germany in 2001. So it was a failure from the start because, you know, the regime did not involve complete different groups in Afghanistan. And Britain and America and NATO only empowered or brought to power the most vicious warlords and drug lords and mass killers and corrupt officials, and that was from the start itself was a failure because everybody was not involved, you know, in that interim government. But then America plus the United Kingdom and NATO and other countries who were involved in Afghanistan, they were not sincere, you know, helping the Afghans. They were only helping those who were at the highest or those who were at the top, you know, for their dirty war in Afghanistan. And the ordinary Afghans, as I say always, did not benefit from the invasion. In 2001, I myself wrote a letter to Tony Blair, as I call him, the war criminal, because he killed 1 million Iraqis and many hundreds of thousands in Afghanistan. I wrote a letter to Tony Blair and I demanded that the Taliban are a bunch of killers in 2001. But what are the replacement in Afghanistan? That who are we going to support? And I received a reply from Tony Blair in 2001. He said, and this is exactly his words, that we will not walk away from the Afghans, and this time we will stay with you until the end. And we saw what they have done in Afghanistan. You know, they did not help the ordinary people.
So, Mr. Asif, could we say that the aim of invading Afghanistan in 2001 was to make the mineral-rich country strategically located between Central and South Asia subservient to the West rather than eliminating the Taliban and al-Qaeda?
The aim was obviously because Afghanistan is a very rich country in resources. You know, we have lithium, which is estimated over $2 trillion. We have a lot of minerals. Afghanistan have gas and oil. Afghanistan has the illicit trade of drugs, you know, which is itself is estimated, you know, nearly $7 or $8 billion a year. And that was one of the purposes, you know, to control these resources. And the other aim was, you know, behind the scene, they were preparing for another illegal war, you know, a war in Iraq where, you know, they destroyed the Iraqi economy. They destroyed the life of 1 million individuals. So two interests were running, you know, concurrently with one another. One was to control the resources in Afghanistan, but it did not work. And the other thing was they were going to launch a war against an illegal war in Iraq. And that's why, you know, when they went to Iraq, Afghanistan was forgotten. The Taliban were getting stronger and stronger and stronger by day. And sadly, you know, end of the day, the innocent Afghan people lost. You know, many of them, hundreds of thousands were killed. People become internally displaced. People have no food. Right now, you know, almost the entire population have no food, you know. And on the top of it, the West is imposing sanctions. Sanction doesn't work. If sanction was working, it would have worked in Cuba. It would have worked on Iraq, in North Korea, in many other countries. But sanction only, you know, hit the poor people. It doesn't reach the rich and the powerful. And that's why, you know, they were defeated, as I said.
Mr. Asif, what about the frozen assets? How do you find the decision to freeze Afghan assets by the Biden administration at a time when the country is teetering at the brink of a major humanitarian catastrophe?
I mean, this is a daylight robbery. You know, it's like you're robbing someone during the day, daylight. You know, this is a robbery. That money doesn't belong to Taliban, or that doesn't money belong to the previous regime of Ashraf Ghani. That money is belonged to the people of Afghanistan. It's the asset of Afghanistan. And, you know, the most powerful country, imagine in 21st century, the most powerful country is stealing money, you know, from the poor or the poorest country on earth, Afghanistan. America is a rich country, but they're stealing the money from the Afghans. And now Biden was saying, or some time ago, Biden was saying this, the money will be divided into two sections. You know, one section will be a compensation for 9/11 victims, you know. But none of the Afghans were involved in 9/11 attack on America. I mean, my sympathies are with the people of America who were innocent and who were brutally killed in that terrorist attack in the United States. But Afghans were not involved, you know. Those who were involved in the conflict in 9/11, they were their close friends, Saudi Arabia. You know, most of the attackers were from Saudi Arabia. Why did the United States seize the asset of Saudi Arabia or the Middle Eastern countries in the United States, where the Saudis investing in trillions? You know, they have countless money invested in the United States.
There you have it, Mr. Asif, the director of Afghan Human Rights Foundation based in Scotland. Thank you for being on the program, sir. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Inger Ashing, CEO of Save the Children, draws attention to the dire situation of children in Afghanistan 1 year since the Taliban takeover, urging the international community to provide aid to save children's lives. American journalist Danny Haypong says the Biden administration is committing a war crime by continuing to hold $7 billion in Afghan assets at a time when more than 90% of population suffers from hunger. Buzz Patterson, an author and consultant, recalls the day 1 year ago when the U.S. executed the worst military operation in Afghanistan, saying it will be taught in military classes as what not to do.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
India and Pakistan were born 75 years ago following a bloody partition engineered by the British. The two nuclear-armed neighbours with a common language, history and culture have since been at odds with deeply troubled relations. They have fought at least three major wars and regularly engage in border skirmishes, mainly in the contested territory of Kashmir, which is divided by a de facto border. Kashmir remains the main bone of contention between the two countries and a major hurdle in the restoration of bilateral relations.
India and Pakistan commemorated 75 years of their independence from British colonialism this week on August 15 and 14, respectively. Celebrations like every year were marked by grand displays. While both countries have undoubtedly taken giant strides in different fields over the years, they haven't quite fulfilled their full potential. In 1947, India's socioeconomic parameters matched those of China, including the level of poverty, literacy, health infrastructure, and etc. Since then, China has galloped ahead of its neighbor to become an economic powerhouse, while India is still struggling to enter the category of developed countries. A burgeoning population, institutional corruption, wrong economic policies, tensions with neighboring countries, political instability, and religious polarization have prevented the Hindu-majority country from marching ahead, as its founding fathers had envisioned. On the other hand, the story of Muslim-majority Pakistan is equally dismaying. The never-changing political instability in the country has greatly impacted its economic outlook. The country is currently in the throes of its worst political, economic, and constitutional crisis in the 75-year-old history. Soaring inflation, growing trade deficit, political crisis, politicized bureaucracy, and feudal system of governance continue to plague the nation 75 years after its creation, making it financially dependent on other countries and global bodies, such as International Monetary Fund.
India and Pakistan were born 75 years ago following a bloody partition engineered by the British. The two nuclear-armed neighbors with a common language, history and culture have since been at odds with deeply troubled relations. They have fought at least three major wars and regularly engage in border skirmishes, mainly in the contested territory of Kashmir, which is divided by a de facto border. Kashmir remains the main bone of contention between the two countries and a major hurdle in the restoration of bilateral relations.
Relations between arch rivals India and Pakistan over the past 75 years have been marked by long spells of hostility and antagonism and short bursts of calm and rapprochement. Their separation in August 1947 resulted in the killing of nearly 2 million people and the displacement of 15 million more. The bloodshed was engineered by Lord Mountbatten, the last British viceroy in India. Barely 2 months after the partition, first war broke out between the newly independent states over the Himalayan region of Kashmir. In January 1949, the 478-mile ceasefire line became a de facto border between them, dividing Kashmir into two parts. In 1965, the Second Indo-Pak War broke out, which was the culmination of a series of border skirmishes. 6 years later, in 1971, another major war between them ended with the birth of Bangladesh. In 1974, India became a nuclear power, while Pakistan's first test came much later in 1998. In 1999, the two militaries engaged each other in a 10-week war in Kargil. Over the past two decades, relations between the two neighbors have seen ebbs and flows, with incidents such as the 2008 Mumbai attacks, the 2019 Pulwama attack, and the revocation of Kashmir's semi-autonomy in August 2019, severely impeding efforts to bring them closer.
Now, to talk more on this, we are joined by Mr. Saptain Ahmed Dar. He is a Pakistani academic and political scientist who is a senior lecturer and research fellow at the University of Lahore. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Ahmed Yar. Now, India and Pakistan are this week marking 75 years of their independence from the British. Now, do you think the two countries can claim to have achieved independence in the true sense of the word?
Yeah, that's a good question. Why? Because it really depends what independence means. If it is in the monetary, in the political, and in the social sense, there are a lot of questions that need to be answered, because Britain and the British Crown still consider Pakistan and India part of their Commonwealth of Nations. And this title basically comes from the British Crown and their royalty and their policy to continuously engage these nations that used to be part of the British colonial apparatus around the world, including some of the African countries and other states, including the states in Asia. Why is that? Because when British, through East India Company, came inside subcontinent, they were not only aiming to destroy the culture, to destroy the lingual background, to destroy the religion of that particular nation, but also they wanted to brainwash such nation into new systems in which the British wanted to rule them, and they wanted to brainwash the coming generation so that they would be continuously ruled by proxies even when they decolonized. So when we saw that in mid 18th century, when British came, they not only colonized, but they created that Raj system inside India, which aimed at exploiting the resources of the subcontinent people. And they had two options at that particular time. One is that through survey, they must understand that what sort of resources India can provide. Yes, we know it was about the limestone and the spices, and it also was meant to change the whole dynamics of subcontinent in such a way that the society becomes an economic province for the British Empire, and that's what they did. So even when we saw the War of Independence, we realized that both the Muslims and the Hindus joined their hands against the British so that they must have their, you know, status back, because they were, you know, being colonized and they were enslaved by these people. And it took them next, at least, you know, 100 years to do that again. But the scenario was different, in which we saw that both Muslims and Indians came, you know, entangled with each other because of two-nation theory, that Muslims and Hindus cannot live with each other.
Mr. Ahmadar, why has India, which was once seen as a competitor of China and some other global powers, lagged behind? And how did the world's second most populous country lose the script?
Because of three main factors. First is the investment, the second is infrastructure, and then eventually manufacturing and production, which is key to the economic growth of any country. When it comes to these three areas, China surpassed the Indian economy during the Xi Jinping government. And this is why even in the Narasimha Rao government during the 1990s, India liberalized its economy. And Narasimha Rao eventually realized that if we have to compete and if we have to, you know, take the pace of the West, we must liberalize the economy just like the West has done. So they opened their gates and removed all of the tariffs in the 1990s, but they were already too late compared to China, which had already done the liberalization process 15 years ago before India during the then Xi Jinping government. And in that particular government, we saw that Deng Xiaoping is sort of a capitalist, and he wants China to open its borders for the investment that is coming from outside. So when it comes to that particular scenario, I personally feel that, you know, it was that timeline of 15 years which made India lag behind China. And there are additional aspects to it. For example, after the Bretton Woods Agreement, when almost every single nation on the face of the planet agreed to peg their currency against the US dollar, I personally feel that American bankers and the big tech inside America decided China to be their perfect market. This is why a lot of business, huge and massive banks, have invested inside China so that they get cheap labor. The top richest families inside the United States, such as the Astors, the Rockefellers, the House of DuPont, and there are other as well. I feel Warburgers as well. They basically invested a lot inside China.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Ahmadar, a Pakistani academic and political scientist who is a senior lecturer and research fellow at the University of Lahore, for being on the program. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Senior Iranian journalist and columnist Rana Ayyub says Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi, in his Independence Day speech, spoke of women's empowerment, while the men accused of gang raping a Muslim woman years ago were released from jail the same day. Preeti Kaur Gill, a British Labour MP, talks about mixed emotions on India and Pakistan celebrating their independence days, noting that millions became refugees and at least 2 million people died during the partition. Data analyst and writer Nafiso Rahman Dorani says the independence days of India and Pakistan are the occasion to remember how the British turned the event into a horrific tragedy for millions of people.
And that was our episode about the first anniversary of the Taliban takeover in Afghanistan and 75 years of independence from colonial rule for India and Pakistan. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take great care.
In the limelight.
The seizure of Palestinian cultural materials by the Zionist regime does not stop with the physical act of confiscation. The Israeli regime hides the materials in its archives.